This week, we consider the symbolic nature of a flower and a man as we dive into Chapter 5 of Max Heindel's Ancient and Modern Initiation. Then we'll read a piece from the New Age magazine, the Scottish Rite Southern Jurisdictions publication from 1917, in a love letter to the brain of man. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 480. I want to thank you all for joining me this week, and I want to give a special thank you to our producers, our fellows, our contributors, and of course, our legacy partners. If you want to learn more about how to support this show, head on over to wcypodcast.com/support the show, or you just click on support the show at the top of the website, and you'll see that you can choose a way to become a partner of the WCY podcast, which has been bringing you Masonic education for 10 years. That's 480 quality episodes for everybody who is interested in Freemasonry, its kindred sciences, and all things craft related. I hope you are all getting along well. In the news this week, I want to go ahead and mention and also thank everybody out there who has been really supportive with the latest book that I published called How to Charter a Lodge, a No-Nonsense Unsanctioned Guide. It's getting some good reviews and feedback from folks. And the idea behind the book, of course, is to give you the insights on how to start a new lodge. And a lot of people are asking, well, we can't even meet right now. Well, what better time to plan? So I hope you guys take that under consideration. I want to give a big thank you to the brothers out in Massachusetts who had me on Zoom to deliver the Esoterics 101 lecture. You know, that lecture is so intense, and it's supposed to be 101. I'm thinking about splitting it into a couple lectures, actually. One on the basis and formation of the different esoteric orders, and then perhaps a step into the direction of Masonic esoteric thought as it pertains to the beginner. If you're listening to this on the 31st, then your next chance to catch a lecture that I'll be doing will be on February 17th, 2021. I'll be doing Freemasonry in America and its Colonial Tavern Beginnings. I'll be doing that for the Consolidated Lodge. So the Consolidated Lodge has a registration page for that. You'll visit theconsolidatedlodge.com/pubcrawl. And by clicking that link, you can check out all the details. A couple days later, I'll be involved with the Scottish Rite Virtual Day of Light. I'll be doing the Esoterics 101 or possibly the Tetragrammaton lectures, which, again, those will be for the Valley of Philadelphia and St. John's Lodge number 1. I think it's an all-day event, but I'm not quite sure on my time slot yet, so we will see. So that's the future for us right now. Don't forget on our website to check out the bookstore. We've got books by various folks who have been on the show, and of course, my personal recommended reading list and recommended books from our guests. And one last piece before we go ahead and get into this week's education. We have a brand new version of a website I've been working on for a long time, and that is called MasonicInstruction.com. What could this new resource be? Well, I'll tell you. MasonicInstruction.com aims to be a place where lodges, no matter where you are in the world, you can go to and hop on and check out a speaker to come visit your lodge, whether to physically go or do a Zoom talk. What we have there when you visit MasonicInstruction.com, it is the Masonic Speakers Association. Now, there is no professional association or anything. It's just the wording that I used. If you click on the Bureau of Speakers, you can browse. And you can see just images and names of all of the people who have listings on our website. Who is there? People like Jason Richards of the Masonic Roundtable, Bill Hosler from the Midnight Freemasons, Joseph Wages, Joe Martinez, Juan Sepulveda, Angel Millar, P.D. Newman, Jamie Paul Lamb, and a host of other wonderful Masonic speakers are there. And their presentation topics, how long they are, a brief description, and a form that when you submit goes directly to them. It doesn't even go through me. I don't see it at all. You are in contact with these lecturers and speakers, and that lets you email them or contact them direct to start scheduling something to go up for your lodge. Now, if you're listening to this and you're a speaker, you have the option of getting listed. So you will just click on the Get Listed link. I have a couple things that I've made mention of here to assist you in filling out your form. I use a Google form to gather the information from you before I build you a page on the website. The Google form asks for just a few things, right? Your name, your Masonic biography, your presentation names, any travel arrangements that you need. We'll need a picture and all of that kind of thing. And of course, this is a totally free thing. I'm not asking for any money. It's just a service for the craft. And I hope you guys really do consider checking out Masonic Speakers Association over at MasonicConstruction.com. And just a quick, cool tool for brothers around the world to be able to find education for their Masonic lodges. So this week, we are diving right back into Ancient and Modern Initiation by Max Heindel, or Hindel, however you would like to pronounce that. This week, we will be diving into Chapter 5, which has a few different sections in it. And if you're interested in previous chapters, please go ahead and listen to previous episodes where we have read the previous chapters. They will pretty much be in succession from this episode moving backward. So, here we go. Chapter 5, The Sacred Shekinah Glory. The western room of the tabernacle was as dark as the heavens are at the time when the lesser light, the moon, is in the western portion of sky at eventide with the sun. That is to say, at the new moon, which begins a new cycle and a new sign of the zodiac, in the westernmost part of this darkened sanctuary stood the Ark of the Covenant, with the cherubim hovering above, and also the fiery Shekinah glory, out of which the Father of Light communed with his worshippers, but which to the physical version was invisible and therefore dark. We do not usually realize that the whole world is a fire, that fire is in the water, that it burns continually in plant, animal, and man. Yes, there is nothing in the work that is not ensouled by fire. The reason why we do not perceive this more clearly is that we cannot disassociate fire and flame, but as a matter of fact, fire bears the same relation to flame as spirit to the body. It is the unseen but potent power of manifestation. In other words, the true fire is dark, invisible to the physical sight. It is only clothed in flame when consuming physical matter. Consider for illustration how fire leaps out of the flint when struck, and how a gas flame has the darkened core beneath the light. Also, how a wire may carry electricity and be perfectly cold, yet it will emit a flame under certain conditions. At this point, it may be expedient to mark the difference between the tabernacle in the wilderness, Solomon's temple, and the later temple built by Herod. There is a very vital difference. Both the miraculously enkindled fire on the brazen altar in the eastern part of the tabernacle and the invisible Shekinah glory in the distant western part of the sanctuary were also present in Solomon's temple. These were thus sanctuaries, in a sense, not equaled by the temple built by Herod. The latter was nevertheless, in a sense, the most glorious of the three, for it was graced by the bodily presence of our Lord Christ Jesus, in whom dwelt the Godhead. Christ made the first self-sacrifice, thereby abrogating the sacrifice of animals, and finally, at the consummation of his work in the visible world, rent the veil and opened a way into the Holy of Holies, not only for a favored few, the priests and Levites, but that whosoever will may come and serve the deity, whom we know as our Father. Having fulfilled the law and the prophets, Christ has done away with the outward sanctuary, and from henceforth the altar of burnt offerings must be set up within the heart to atone for wrongdoing. The golden candlestick must be lighted within the heart to guide us upon our way, as the Christ within, the Shekinah glory of the Father, must dwell within the sacred precincts of our own God consciousness. The shadow of the cross. Paul, in his letter to the Hebrews, gives description of the tabernacle and much information about the customs used there, which it would benefit the student to know. Among other things, note that he calls the tabernacle a shadow of good things to come. There is, in this ancient mystery temple, a promise given which has not yet been fulfilled. a promise that holds good today just as well as upon the day it was given. If we visualize in our mind the arrangement of things inside the tabernacle, we shall readily see the shadow of the cross. Commencing at the eastern gate, there was the altar of burnt offerings. A little farther along the path to the tabernacle itself, we find the laver of consecration, the molten sea in which the priests washed. Then, upon entering the east room of the temple, we find an article of furniture, the golden candlestick, at the extreme left, and the table of showbread, at the extreme right, the two forming a cross, with the path we have been pursuing toward and within the tabernacle. In the center, in front of the second veil, we find the altar of incense, which forms the center of the cross, while the ark, placed in the westernmost part of the west room, the Holy of Holies, gives the short upper limb of the cross. In this manner, the symbol of spiritual unfoldment, which is our particular ideal today, was shadowed forth in the ancient mystery temple, and that consummation which is attained at the end of the cross, the achievement of getting the law within, as it was within the ark itself, is the one that we must all concern ourselves with at the present time. The light that shines over the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies at the head of the cross, at the end of the path in this world, is a light or reflection from the invisible world into which the candidate seeks to enter when all the world has grown dark and black about him. Only when we have attained to that stage where we perceive the spiritual light that beckons us on, the light that floats over the ark, only when we stand in the shadow of the cross can we really know the meaning, the object, and the goal of life. At present, we may take the opportunities which are offered and perform a service more or less efficiently, but it is only when we have by that service evolved the spiritual light within ourselves, which is the soul body, and when we have thus gained admission to the West Room, called the Hall of Liberation, that we can really perceive and understand why we are in the world and what we need in order to make ourselves properly useful. We may not remain, however, when access has been gained. The high priest was only allowed to enter once a year. There was a very long interval of time between these glimpses of the real purpose of existence. In the times between, it was necessary for the high priest to go out and function among his brethren, humanity, and serve them to the very best of his ability. Also to sin, because he was not yet perfect, and then re-enter the Holy of Holies after having made proper amends for his sins. Similar it is with ourselves at this day. We at times attain glimpses of the things that are in store for us, and the things we must do to follow Christ to that place where he went. You remember that he said to his disciples, "Ye cannot follow me now, but ye shall follow me later." And so it is with us. We have to look again and again into the darkened temple, the Holy of Holies, before we are really fit to stay there, before we are really fitted to take the last step and leap to the summit of the cross, the place of the skull, that point in our heads where the spirit takes its departure when it finally leaves the body, or off and on, as in Invisible Helper. That Golgotha is the ultimate of human attainment, and we must be prepared to enter the darkened room many times before we are fitted for the final climax. The full moon as a factor in soul growth. Let us now consider the path of initiation as symbolically shown in the ancient temples with the Ark, Fire, and Shekinah, and in the latter temples where Christ taught. Note first that when man was expelled from the Garden of Eden because he had eaten of the tree of knowledge, cherubim guarded the entrance with a flaming sword. Passages like the following, quote, "Adam knew Eve, and she bore Abel. Adam knew Eve, and she bore Seth. Elkanah knew Hannah, and she bore Samuel." Also Mary's question to the angel Gabriel, "How shall I conceive, seeing that I know not a man?" All show plainly that indulgence of the passions in the creative act was meant by the phrase eating the tree of knowledge. When the creative act was performed under inauspicious planetary rays, it was a sin committed against the laws of nature, which brought pain and death into the world, estranged us from our primal guardians, and forced us to roam the wilderness of the world for ages. At the gate of the mystic temple of Solomon, we find the cherubim, but the fiery sword is not longer in their hand. Instead, they hold a flower, a symbol full of mystic meaning. Let us compare man with a flower that we may know the great import and significance of the emblem. Man takes his good by way of the head, whence it goes downward. The plant takes its nourishment through the root and forces it upward. Man is passionate in love, and he turns the generative organ toward the earth and hides it in shame because of this taint of passion. The plant knows no passion. Fertilization is accomplished in the most pure and chaste manner imaginable. Therefore, it projects the generative organ, the flower, toward the sun, a thing of beauty which delights all who behold it. Passionate fallen man exhales the deadly carbon dioxide. The chaste flower inhales this poison, transmutes it, and gives it back pure, sweet, and scented, a fragrant elixir of life. This was the mystery of the Grail Cup. This is the emblematic significance of the Cup of Communion, which is called Kelch. In German, calyx. In Latin, both names mean signifying the seed pod of the flower. The communion cup, with its mystic blood cleansed from the passion incident to generation, brings to him who truly drinks thereof eternal life. And thus it becomes the vehicle of regeneration, of the mystic birth into a higher sphere, a foreign country, where he who has served his apprenticeship in temple building and has mastered the art and crafts of this world may learn higher things. The symbol of the cherubim with the open flower placed upon the door of Solomon's temple delivers the message to the aspirant that purity is the key by which alone he can hope to unlock the gate to God. Or as Christ expressed it, quote, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God," end quote. The flesh must be consumed on the altar of self-sacrifice, and the soiled must be washed in the laver of consecration to the higher life, where it may approach the temple door, when, naked, poor, and blinded, by tears of contrition, it gropes in the darkness. Seeing the temple door, it shall find entrance to the hall of service, the east room of the tabernacle, which is ablaze with light from the seven-branched candlestick, emblematic of the luminosity of the full moon. The moon changing in cycles of 7 days. In this hall of service, the aspirant is taught to weave the luminous vesture of flame, which Paul called the soul body, 1 Corinthians 15:44, from the aroma of the showbread. When we speak of the soul body, we mean exactly what we say, and this vehicle is, in no ways, to be confused with the soul that permeates it. The invisible helper who uses it on soul flights knows it to be as real and tangible as the dense body of flesh blood, but within that golden wedding garment, there is an intangible something cognized by the spirit of introspection. It is unnameable and indescribable. It evades the most persistent efforts to fathom it, yet it is there just as certainly as the vehicles which it fills. Yes, and more so, it is not life, love, beauty, wisdom, nor can any other human concept convey an idea of what it is. For it is the sum of all human faculties, attributes, and concepts of good, immeasurably intensified. If everything else were taken from us, that prime reality would still remain, and we should be rich in its possession, for through it we feel the drawing power of our Father in heaven, that inner urge which all aspirants know so well. To this inner something Christ referred when he said, quote, "No man cometh to me except through my Father draw through him." Just as the true fire is hidden in the flame that encloses it, so unnameable, intangible something hides in the soul body and burns up the frankincense extracted from the showbread. Thus, it lights the fire which makes the soul body luminous, and the aroma of loving service to others penetrates the veil as a sweet savor to God, who dwells in the Shekinah glory, similarly created above the ark in the innermost sanctuary, the Holy of Holies. Well, there you have the fifth chapter. There's a lot that goes on here, and to the untrained or the passive listener, it might sound overtly very evangelical in nature. However, it's important to understand what they're talking about here is the inner Christ. The portion I found extremely interesting was the idea of consistently visiting the darkness and the portal of the mind. So your question this week is, in relation to visiting this darkness, let's attribute it perhaps to meditation. How often are you meditating or taking time to think and clear your mind? Are you doing it daily, weekly, monthly? Let's hear what you have to say. The next piece I have for you this week comes from the New Age magazine, stemming from 1917. This was the publication of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite southern jurisdiction of the United States, the Supreme Council's magazine. And on occasion, there is confusion among the workmen because the magazine is called the New Age, and yet there is another magazine, you know, in the profane world, although it is an occult magazine called the New Age also. This piece is called The Man, His Brain, by Dr. Reuben T. Clark, 32nd degree, and it begins with a quote. I have a room wherein no one enters, save I myself alone. There sits a blessed memory on a throne. There my life centers. Rossetti. The brain is the controlling center to which all the senses report, and from which all impulse leaves. These may be voluntary or involuntary, conscious or unconscious. This organ, together with its triple coverings, is almost entirely enclosed within the bones of the cranium, and in the normal man weighs a little over 3 pounds, practically 50 ounces, whereas the woman's brain weighs from 3 to 5 ounces less. The brain, with its peculiar makings, is divided into two distinct halves, somewhat like the half of an English walnut. The right and left hemispheres are again divided into 5 lobes as a greater convenience to study. A study of the histological anatomy and physiology alone of the brain can easily consume the lifetime of an untiring student, without revealing all of its microscopical beauty and its psychological possibilities, has already exhausted the most careful research of those who have attempted to gain entrance into one's individuality, which God has not duplicated since the beginning of time. The full capacity of the brain, with its 13,000 million cells, of which few men seldom use over 1 or 2 million, the capacity, therefore, is limited only by one's physical endurance. These very phenomena should appeal to students and suggest to them that it is not wise to lose one's health in the pursuit of wisdom. However, the size and weight of the brains, and they vary several ounces, are not the important features. It is the texture of consistency of its various departments by which an autopsy determines the active intelligence of a man in his recent state. When dissection of a highly developed brain is undertaken, it is found that the tissue tears very easily under the knife, whereas a dull brain, the tissue will cut as smoothly as a head of cheese. The fissures, or sulci or sulci, with their shelf-like tears, which map off the lobes of both halves of the brain, indicate by their depth and creasing the degree of development which the man had attained in his sphere of activity. As a rough, well-marked bone indicates physical work during the period of growth, just so a well-marked, deeply furrowed brain indicates both study and thought in early life. To build a strong, bony framework for the body, which is its foundation structure, a person must do physical labor during their growing years so as to force the bones to grow strong. This is quite as true of the brain, which must lay off its thought and habit markings before it is set with age. One writer claims that it is almost impossible to learn the native pronunciation of a language after 40 years of age. True, a few words and sentences can be learned, as Deutschland or Si vis passum per bellum, but the articulation of which sounds to the scholar somewhat like the following would to a reader: Henry ist der two Ds, or von D in Mutter. Of course, we readily understand that Henry was asked how to spell butter. The depth and shaving of certain fissures indicate, too, by their specific location, the kind of work, mind work, in which the subject was engaged. By these exact, irregular canals through the brain tissue, the investigators of today cannot only recognize the difference between a lawyer's brain and that of an artist, each with their exact peculiar sulci, but the brain detectives can also distinguish a marked difference between the line of a prosecuting attorney's brain, with its deeply marked brocas, or speech, convolutions, from that of a civil lawyer's brain, with the speech centers not so well emphasized, but possessed of a more finely traced psychological area. Each phase, with its specific microscopical location, as exact as in the focus of the eyes. To the student, along these lines, the brain becomes more interesting with each bit of research and discovery. After the European War, these students took for great volume of new information to be washed up by the blood of millions, wounded and slain. The brain is where the dreadnought, the super dreadnought, and now the super super dreadnoughts were first launched. It is where Marconi first dreamed wireless, and where Dr. Andrew Taylor still first conceived the therapeutic principle of osteopathy. It is where systems of war and systems of peace are first warred out and pieced out. The brain is where fright comes to pale the cheek, and where anger to flush it again. It is the tower from whence tender love and unholy passions flash their messages through the eyes. The brain is a throne where kind thoughts may come to rule, or where gossip or scandal may sneak in and tear the beautiful robe of character from another's back. It is also the dungeon where the leper pessimist lives with his companion, idleness, and his jailer, his hate. The brain, to the optimist, is a shaded pathway through the woods to the skyline of life's worthwhile, where he brings together the memory children of yesterday and his hopes of tomorrow. It is the playground of youth, the battlefield of a soldier, and the arena of life, where all must interpret and dispose of each hour. It is the fruit tree of experience, where lad and lass are wont to go, in youth's fancy free, and build there beneath its flowering branches their homes of happiness. The brain is the dreamer's palatial home and the only shop where the poor man can spend his golden wishes and silver hopes extravagantly. How rich these dreamers are! The brain is where the financier makes his money. It is, however, a valueless currency to the spendthrift, the indolent, and the thoughtless, even though it be the center from which health is largely controlled. In this mental house, there is a secret back room to which we permit our normal appetites to sometimes go, and there our thoughts too often brew a wine of wild cats, and drink till the light of judgment is upset. 'Tis then the man stumbles out of the darkened door to secretly share with some fancy young woman both sin and disease. Those who read character could well say, quote-unquote, cover the brain with what you will, hair of any color, or a hat of any style, one cannot hide what they have sought to gather there from the eyes of the world. The soul of man speaks through his eyes, and his character is written into his face. The brain is a vast court of education from whence justice and judgment come. It is the mill of the gods where character with his chosen assistant, environment, works silently upon the feature lines of the living soul. Together, these twin forces, character and environment, work side by side as one man, tireless, continuously, with the only tools which his faculties bring him. These are the senses, dull at first, but each year sharpened by experience, becoming more skilled by well-directed efforts in giving the final touch of expression to his immortal work, ere the hands of death reach forth and take away the wonderful tools of life. It is the realm where youth reigns as king. His senses are loyal subjects. Why not send these faculty captains to seek out and find relief among the highway of life, going into the avenues of music, art, science, business, and literature, to sound the depth of hearing, to sight the boundless sea, to feel the touch of the soul, to smell the scent of the rose. Thus the hearing, seeing, feeling, and scenting of our fathers and forefathers, their wanderings, ambitions, and cravings, projected from life to life, into thee and me, that we might taste the wine of knowledge, which was poured by each for each, and at last for me and thee. During active youth, these willing servants should be trained to go into the boundless vineyards of information to bring back the imperishable fruits from there, to be carefully stored away in the cells of the brain. Let us suppose that this has been done, and we will now follow the student as he lifts the bones from the skull and lays back the coverings of the brain. He has gathered his desire from the deep, broad fields of study and distilled from these fruits the very wine of intellect, eloquent and beautiful, with which to portray the very tissues of thought, the flashing functions of a man's matchless organ, so capable of mastering every aim and aspiration of the life itself. Thus I pay humble tribute to the brain, and in so speaking of it, there is also revealed the twin beauty and the equal importance of the spinal cord, with its ascending and descending tract, so wonderful and so accurate in the transmission of impulses to and from the brain, to and from the entire activity of the body, voluntary and involuntary. This human brain, so like a wonderful machine, is completely and perfectly exact in health with the image of the Maker stamped there. The whole is charged with life, with its thousand of branching tracts which ramifies every molecule of the body, each atom with its special part to play in its properly staging the energy of life's uncertain span. This span is builded, broadened, and beautified by ambition's untiring pursuit after knowledge, at times weary under the flickering light of the midnight oil, just as it gives to the body over to the subconscious mind to be restored and toned by sleep, sufficient for another day's toil. As life is made of many days, so is the body made up of many parts, all linked together through the spinal cord, every part having a voice in the administration of the whole interpreted and modified by the brain. Still, this life, as a chain, is no stronger than its weakest link, the mind. What an awful thing to lose. For when it is sane, 'tis God's best gift. The greatest study of mankind is man, and when more is learned of his brain endowed with the faculties capable of gaining all that other thought has mastered, and more, with an increasing knowledge of self, this knowledge should ever command a greater love for our fellow man than God, the master of mind. Well, there you go. A great piece by Dr. Reuben T. Clark, 32nd degree, coming again from the New Age magazine, Scottish Rite publication of the Southern Jurisdiction way, way back in January of 1917. So for our Craftsman Plus, our second question of this week is, do you still feel the call to knowledge? Do you still get sucked into interesting side topics that pull you into 30 open tabs on your computer, researching everything you can? And if you do, what is the latest thing that you've really taken an interest in, philosophical or not? Maybe you want to learn how a steam engine works. Well, tell us about it. Maybe you're curious about Thomas Aquinas's expansive views of deity. Who knows? But let us know what you're really into right now. Tell us what you're currently researching. That's all for this week. I want to thank you all for joining me on this episode of the Whence Came You podcast. One more time, I want to reach out and thank our producers, our contributors, our fellows, and our legacy partners. For everybody out there listening, be excited, because this year we're going to hear some episodes that are directed by our legacy partners as they request and put together the special material needed for some amazing episodes. I hope to see you out there in digital presentation land, and I hope you're all staying safe. If you want to use your COVID hunker down time to study how to start a lodge, please consider picking up the book, How to Charter a Lodge, a no-nonsense, unsanctioned guide. Within that book, we've got a lot of great insight, and even if you're not going to be starting a lodge now, it's got a lot of great information in there regarding revamping a lodge, or even if you're going to be working on your bylaws, all of these kinds of things. So I hope you enjoy it. It's about 150 pages, but by no means is it a difficult read, and I hope you all enjoy it. I'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. And for Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.